Bereshit bara Elohim, et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz, ve'ha'aretz, hayata tohu vavohu ve'choshech al pnei tohom, ve'ruach Elohim mirachefes al pnei hamayim. Classic, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Other way of reading it, in the beginning of God's creation of the heavens and the earth started out as tohu vavohu, chaotic and void, and darkness over the expanse of that which had been created, and the Spirit of God floated over the water. We'll talk about that later, but soon. OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Shabbat Bereshit. Notice I didn't say Shabbat Parshat Bereshit or Parshat Bereshit, because this is one of the Shabbatot that is actually named for the Sedra that we read on that Shabbat. I don't know if I'm making too much of a fuss about it, but just in contrast, next week is Shabbat Parshat Noach, which means the Shabbat on which we read Shabbat Noach. This Shabbat is known as more than the Shabbat on which we read Parshat Bereshit. It is Shabbat Bereshit, a reliving of the first Shabbat of creation. And there's, I think, a very significant and qualitative difference as to how we are supposed to react to this particular Shabbat. You heard at the beginning a classic piece from 613 Torah Avenue on the 7 days of creation, 6 days plus Shabbat. And I'm not too sure that there are any listeners to Torah Tidbits Audio who grew up with 613 Torah Avenue, but I'm willing to bet that there are some people who are listening whose children or grandchildren grew up on 613 Torah Avenue. I know to a certain extent mine did. It was very, very popular, and I'm glad to see that it is alive and well on the internet. You can find many clips on YouTube, and what I do is use one of the online conversion programs, pardon the expression, to convert the YouTube clip video into a MP3 format so that I could bring it into this program, which is called Power Sound Editor Free, even though I paid for it. And this is what I do the show on. Recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday. Interesting. Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 25th day of Tishrei 5779, corresponding this year to October 4th. Okay, where do we begin? Let's begin, as we usually do, with either Psalm 130 or 121. Today's case will be 121, since we don't say Tachanun from after Yom Kippur through the rest of the month of Tishrei into Rosh Chodesh Mar Cheshvan, and only starting on the 2nd of Mar Cheshvan do we resume saying of Tachanun. So we have now Tehillim Kuf Kaf Aleph, Psalm 121. Shir Lama Alot, Asa Einai El Heharim Me'ayin Yavo Ezri. Ezri Me'im Adonai Osei Shamayim Va'aretz. Al Yitain Lamot Raglecha Al Yanum Shomerecha. Hine Lo Yanum Velo Yishan Shomer Yisrael. Adonai Shomerecha Adonai Tzilecha Al Yad Yeminecha. Yomam Hashemesh Lo Yakecha Ve'oreach Balayla. Adonai Yishmorcha Mikol Ro Yishmor Et Nafshecha. Adonai Yishmor Tzeitecha Uvoecha Me'ata V'ad Olam. Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanatunim Batzara Uvashivya Ha'omedim Bein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha Hamakom Yerachem Aleihem V'yotziyem Mitzara Lirvacha U'me'afela La'ora U'mishibud L'geula Hashta Ba'agala U'vizman Kariv V'nomar Amen. Let me start with the other parenthetical name of this Shabbat, not unique, but this one applies, and that is Rosh Chodesh benching, Shabbat Mevorachim. Interesting is that Bereshit is always Shabbat Mevorachim, the month of Mar Cheshvan. No other parsha can make the same claim. So, of course, I got curious and I did a diagram chart of the whole year. Take, for example, next month, Kislev. Rosh Chodesh Kislev, we announce usually on Parshat Chayei Sarah, but occasionally on Toledot. Following month, Tevet, usually Parshat Vayeshev. Once in a while, it comes out Miketz. Now, that's the mild version of it. In Torah Tidbits in the print, you can click on the PPW file, which has a name, you know, Parsha Picks and Word of the Month. And there, you see the whole schmear. It gets a little more complicated when it comes to the months from Adar, one Adar, two Adars, and then Nisan, and then further you have double sedras that are sometimes split and sometimes read together, and then you have an additional complication of the weeks, which Chutz Laaretz and Israel are out of sync as far as Parshat HaShavua is concerned, until it quiets down all the way in Elul, where usually Parshat Re'eh is Mevorchim Chodesh Elul, and once in a while Akev. Again, this Shabbat, we announce Rosh Chodesh Mar Cheshvan will be Yom Shalishi and Yom Revi'i, Tuesday and Wednesday, Haba Aleinu Latova, that are coming unto us for the good. And I also want to emphasize that even though many, many people refer to the month after Tishrei as Cheshvan, that is not the correct name of the month. And those who think that Mar is a prefix to Cheshvan, meaning bitter, because there are no Chagim like Tishrei had, are wrong, because it is not Mar Cheshvan, it is Mar Cheshvan, if you have to break it up. And I checked in old sources, namely Tanakh, we don't find it. All of Rashi's writings, Mar Cheshvan is the name of the month, no reference to Cheshvan. All of Rambam's writing, no reference. And whatever else I was able to check, until I got to the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch, who refers to the month as Cheshvan. I believe it was a nickname that made it shorter, so you didn't have to write it out, Mar Cheshvan. And it stuck. But in documents like a ketuvah and lahavdil, and more importantly, a get, the month has to be identified as Mar Cheshvan. That's the name of the month. I did not have a chance to ask. I don't know who I would ask. I need some kind of an expert in documents that if a ketuvah was dated in Cheshvan, would it invalidate the ketuvah? I don't know. But let's leave it at that. And the purists among us, the calendar aficionados, should call the month Mar Cheshvan, and so I believe should everybody else. So that is the story of Rosh Chodesh benching and the coming month of Mar Cheshvan. Actually, we're not finished the story yet. Tishrei, in our fixed calendar, always has 30 days. That means that the 30th day is the first day of Rosh Chodesh of the following month, and the first day of the following month is the second day of Rosh Chodesh. 2 days Rosh Chodesh, when a month has 30 days, the following month has 2 days Rosh Chodesh, as we find with Mar Cheshvan. However, Mar Cheshvan itself usually has 29 days to be followed by a single day of Rosh Chodesh Kislev, but in certain years which are designated Shalem and an extra day is necessary, that extra day is the 30th of Mar Cheshvan. Mar Cheshvan that then has 30 days, its 30th day being the first day of Rosh Chodesh Kislev, and then the first day of Kislev is the second day of Rosh Chodesh Kislev. If you've been following, the same would apply to Tevet, which is Rosh Chodesh during Hanukkah, by the way, and that depends on the status of Kislev. Now, Kislev usually has 30 days, so Tevet will usually be 2 days Rosh Chodesh. However, in years designated as chaser, deficient or missing, when we need to take away a day in order for the calendar to work out smoothly, the day that is removed is the 30th of Kislev. In those years, Tevet will have only 1 day Rosh Chodesh. Specifically, it is the sixth candle of Chanukah that is always Rosh Chodesh, and the seventh sometimes is, usually, but not always. Got that? If you didn't, we're moving on anyway. Okay, now we get down to Tachlis. I read the first two psukim of Bereshit. Usually I read the first pasuk of a sedra. I read the first two on purpose because of what I am about to present. I've done this before, but this year, this time, is the first time that I am presenting it, except for the short lead tidbit in the printed version, which I did not have a chance to do justice to, has a new, let's say, backdrop towards my bringing up the topic. The backdrop is Dan Brown's latest book called Origin. Those of you who have read The Da Vinci Code, which is his most famous novel, that was preceded by Angels and Demons, which was a very enjoyable book. It takes place before Da Vinci Code, but most people, myself included, read Da Vinci Code first because of the fame that it had. And then, if they liked it, which I did, you went back and you read Angels and Demons. Be that as it may, Origin is the fourth of his novels that has the symbologist, I don't know, Professor Robert, I don't even remember exactly the name. I see it and I know who it is and I pass over it. I feel a little sheepish about that. Anyway, it's main overwhelming theme is a student and colleague of his named Edmund Kirsch is a super computer, super programmer, has invented the most advanced computer in the world and set it the task of simulating the origin of life in order to show that it can happen without a creative designer, without God. And I have many, many bones to pick with Dan Brown and the way the book was presented. But I'm just using it as a backdrop here. And I will tell you the personal story that started me in this whole thing. And eventually we're going to get to these first two psukim in Bereshit. Sixth grade, Crown Heights Yeshiva, way back in the late 50s. I am sitting in sixth grade secular studies, mixed boys and girls. Limudei Kodesh was separated from third grade back in my time. And our teacher is doing a lesson in general science, which included a unit on geology. And she happened to have mentioned that rocks are 4.5 billion years old. Now, when she said that, maybe she was looking for the surprise effect on the students, or not. But the students looked at each other, and somehow, within a couple of seconds, all attention was focused on me. Apparently, I don't really remember it, but I think it do. I was the mouthpiece in the class, and they were all encouraging me to say something, even though it was on everybody's mind. So I raised my hand, and teacher called on me with a very snappy, "Yes, Philip." And I said, rocks can't be 4.5 billion years old, because the world was only created 5,715, 16 years ago, whatever it was then. And she smirked and said, "Nonsense. Bother your morning teachers." Our morning teachers were Limudei Kodesh, Jewish studies teachers, and we eagerly awaited the Rebbe, an older European refugee from World War II, whose English was not so great. Yiddish was his native tongue. And we asked if we can ask a question before class. And he, of course, welcomed that. And we told him the story from the day before and the statement that rocks were 4.5 billion years old. He looked at us and he smiled. He did not smirk. He smiled, a very beneficent kind of smile, and said, "Narishkeit," which for those who don't know even the rudimentary Yiddish, means nonsense. And that was it. Sixth grade, how old are you? Bar mitzvah in eighth grade in my time. So 11. 11 years old. And you have a question about an apparent conflict between our Jewish tradition of the age of the earth and the scientific claims of the age of the earth, and nobody was home to answer the question. Our answers came as nonsense and narishkeit, what the opposite meant, and we were left with no solution. I can't say that at that point I made my decision of what I wanted to be when I grew up, but in retrospect, my choice was very much influenced by that experience. And that was to teach Limudei Kodesh, Jewish studies, and math and science, which I ended up doing till I came on Aliyah, and to some extent have been doing ever since, because of my experience subsequent in Yeshiva University High School of Brooklyn for Boys, which doesn't exist anymore and was always called BTA when it did exist. And I had my first religious science teacher, a rabbi doctor, no, maybe just Rabbi Fred Bohensky, who I understand is still around, and I would love to be in touch with him. And maybe I'll get to it one of these days, and I hope I will. And he not only was religious and taught biology, but he did not leave his hashkafa, his belief, his outlook from the Jewish point of view outside of the classroom. It came in and actively was used together with the science that he was teaching and we were trying to learn. Following that, in Yeshiva University, I was fortunate enough to have teachers like Dr. Eli Levine, Zichrono Livracha, Lahavdil Ben Chaim Lachaim, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler, who I had for three different biology courses, even though he also was a Gemara teacher, and another person who was not religious in the traditional sense, but who is very traditional in the religious sense. I don't know if that makes any sense. If it does, you could use it also. Professor Dr. William Etkin, Zichrono Livracha, who really, really brought together the Torah and science and fused them where science is knowledge. Science specifically is knowledge of nature and of the world that God created, and it is definitely part of Torah. Now, even though I said that the backdrop is the Dan Brown book, whose character was attempting to show that life can be formed without a God creating the world, our hashkafa, my hashkafa, I hope is our hashkafa, our outlook is that the first premise and given position is God created everything. And then to look at science and see not how life can be formed or created without God, but to see how God chose to create life. Anything that I say is going to be simplified of necessity, time-wise, as well as audience-wise, since we're not sitting together and we don't know each other, all of us, except for Mark and Flo and Larry and a bunch of other people that I know listen. Anyway, my starting point for understanding the problem that came up back in my sixth grade is these first two psukim of Bereshit. Because I believe that the third verse, Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, God said, let there be light, is dated to the 25th of Elul before the first year, day six of creation in that same first chapter of Bereshit, corresponds to the first of Tishrei, at least according to some opinions, of the first year from creation, of which we have just begun the 5,779th year. And we'll talk about that more. In contrast with the first two psukim, which occurred before the days of creation, in an unidentifiable period of time, which can range from a fraction of a second to billions of years and everything in between, totally insignificant in arguing how long it took, because the concept of time was not yet an organized part of creation. I believe, and I'm not the only one, that the first psukim describe phase one of creation, which is called Yesh Me'ayin, something from nothing. God created, God originally was the only existence that there was. To say that he was alone is a misleading kind of thing, because his oneness and his aloneness and his existence cannot be properly described with our language, since we speak human talk in whatever variation it is, and it does not relate properly and well to the infinite and to God. After the undeterminable period of creation of Yesh Me'ayin, ex nihilo, something from nothing, you had the organization by God of everything that had been created in the chaotic mixture and was now delineated and separated and named and identified and given laws of nature to follow. That's described in the 6 days of creation, which earlier I seemed to indicate were the same as days as we know it. And I personally have no problem believing that that is within the capabilities of God to have done. And those people that are more comfortable using the Pasuk in Tehillim, that one day, that 1,000 years of our time is like one day in God's eyes, and not just applying it literally to say that each day of creation was 1,000 years, but to take it figuratively and to say that each day of creation was an eon, an epoch, a period of time that, again, we don't have details about. And I believe that you can choose how to view the 6 days of creation, but I also believe that you cannot categorically state this idea is ridiculous, because if you do, it limits the power of God. Okay, we can discuss it, and I would not mind feedback on any of these points. But let's go back to the Bereshit period. If I'm describing that as an unknowable period of time, and even that might not be appropriate way to say it, then if we include that instant or more of creation, then it throws the timing of anything that we look at today, so that applying the conventional tests, scientific studies and tests, to show the age of rock as 4.5 billion years old, that could include our 5,779 years and the unidentifiable period that preceded it. Especially if you accept the notion, as expressed in Medrash, that God previously created and destroyed many, many worlds, and all of that can be viewed as part of Bereshit Bara Elokim Et HaShemayim Ve'et Haaretz Va'aretz Hayta Tohu Va'bohu, so that all those things, however long they existed, are included in the makeup of the world that we have today, which means that timing is thrown completely off. And the best you can say is a rock, if left to be formed, totally by nature as we know it today would take 4.5 billion years to form, I'm fine with that because there's a condition put onto it, which then has, however, when God created the rock, he was not bound by the laws of nature which he created in order to set the rock going from after the act of creation. I don't know if that confused anybody. It would mean that if I needed a piece of paper that was 100 years old, I could produce it in two ways. I could find a piece of paper that's 100 years old, or I can simulate conditions to age, to accelerate the aging process of the paper to be like a 100-year-old piece of paper. And they would be totally indistinguishable from each other because something that takes 100 years without intervention can take an hour with intervention. A world that is formed totally by the laws of nature through observing nature today and then extrapolating backwards to a point where something started, be it 65 million years ago or 4.5 billion years ago or whatever, is a way of talking in our terms. But when you say something that the dinosaurs existed 65 million years ago, there are two ways of understanding that. There's one that has a premise that if everything that we see today, in other words, fossil remains of dinosaurs and all kind of geological observations in different strata of the Earth, if that had come about by totally natural causes, then you can say this happened 65 million years ago. In Hebrew, there's a word that kids learn from a very early age, which is ke'ilu, as if. Even when we say in the Haggadah, Chayav Adam lirot et atzmo ke'ilu hu yatzah mimitzrayim, that we have to show as if, we have to act as if we ourselves came out of Mitzrayim, there is a recognition in the word ke'ilu that we can't do a perfect simulation of coming out of Egypt because we didn't come out of Egypt. But we can get close to that in the ke'ilu style. I'm applying this word now that rocks are ke'ilu 4.5 billion years old, even though they were part of a creation that occurred 5,779 years ago. I guess we have to now say, based on what I've been saying, plus an undeterminable amount of time. So there really isn't a contradiction. So if we now add the time, put the word in quotes, Joey Sari quotes, of Bereshit bara Elokim baretz hayata tohu vavohu, then add more to the 6 days of creation and how long they actually were. Let's talk about that for one moment. When God said, Tadshei ha'aretz desha, let the world spring forth with vegetation, it is, to me, maybe not scientific, but certainly acceptable and understandable and believable, and talk about belief and knowledge in a moment also, that there was a fast-forward process to bring vegetation to a certain stage in each sample of vegetation's own life cycle, where in the course of part of day three, there were trees that sprouted from the ground, grew into saplings, developed into trees, and aged to the point where the tree died and was petrified and fossilized. And that can be a day's work by God, so to speak, or half day. And it comes to simulate millions and millions of years. In fact, if you've read Origen already, it just hit me that he obviously did not actually go through millions of years of evolutionary process, but he simulated it on a computer, on a supercomputer. He simulated it in a relatively short period of time, giving it the ability to act in such a theoretical, virtual way that it would have taken millions and millions of years, which sort of is very compatible with Bereshit Bara Elokim Et HaShemayim Ve'et HaAretz. Anyway, I don't know if I'm babbling or I'm saying things that you can bite into and discuss with your families and or argue with me about, but let's add to what I just said, the two parts of the Bereshit part and the 6 days of creation part. Add then all of the years till the flood, where laws of nature might have been different, probably were different, proof of which is the longevity that is recorded for certain people in the Torah. And then the Mabul, which was a suspension of laws of nature, and an aging process could have taken place in the course of that year, which was the equivalent of millions of years or more. And then, only after the flood and things got back to, quote, normal, can we then claim that that things proceeded according to the laws of nature that God created, with the exception of miraculous events, which were God's suspension of his laws of nature. There's a whole school of thought that says that the 10 plagues in Egypt were each a suspension of laws of nature meant to show us that it is God who created the world, because it is only God who is capable of saying for the following day or week or whatever, things will not behave in the normal way, but in opposite ways. Do I believe that hail, which rained down on Egypt in punishment as one of the Makot, was ice containing fire? The answer is yes, I believe it. The answer, maybe a little bit more comfortably, is yes, it certainly is possible that that's what God did, because the law of nature that says that the heat of fire would melt ice can be suspended only by God, who created it in the first place, to not burn, to not melt the ice. Not different from the burning bush. And even when scientists come out with their own theories as to how to explain the splitting of the sea or the fire in the ice, they are grasping at straws in order to insist that God didn't create the world and there is no God that is running the show. And we're just coming from a totally different starting point. Because if you come from your starting point of Bereshit Bara Elokim, if you come from your starting point of Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Mibeit Avadim, then you need to see everything that you can witness in science through those glasses, through that perspective. I've definitely told the Sesame Street piece about Sherlock Hemlock, the world's greatest detective, and I would love to tell it again, but I'm not going to. So if you don't know what it is, look it up or ask. But the fact of the matter is that that children's humor sketch made me very aware of the fact that no conclusion can be drawn only from observations. Conclusions can be drawn with a foundation of different premises upon which observations combine with the premise in order to help me draw a conclusion. In the case of Sherlock Hemlock, world's greatest detective, the presence, I'm not doing justice to it, I'm sorry, the presence of party hats and horns and half-eaten pieces of cake with a candle in it and gift wrapping, together with the knowledge of birthdays that are celebrated by birthday parties, which sometimes have party hats and horns and cake with candles that people eat, and gifts that are wrapped in pretty wrapping paper. And that is separate from the observation. The evidence, the observation, did not see the birthday party, did not hear happy birthday being sung to the main principal. It was only pieces of evidence like the hat, the horn, the cake, and the candle, and the gift wrapping. When Sherlock Hemlock came up with a different theory to explain everything that he found, he was equally satisfied that he had read the situation correctly, even though he did not witness Tweedlebugs doing their annual jelly bean dance and did not witness the candle monster trying to chase away the Tweedlebugs. But he also took the evidence, the observations, and built upon premises, true or false, to draw a different conclusion. So Stephen Hawking might have succeeded in mathematically proving that you can explain everything on Earth without having to mention the G word or believe in the G word, God, but doesn't mean that there is no God. And to me, that's a flaw, both in this Edmund Kirsch from Dan Brown's book and Stephen Hawking and others like it, who are attempting to say, A, I don't believe in God. I don't believe that God created the world. But if you ask me how the world exists the way it does without a creator, I can show you a mathematical model or a computer simulation or various things which I will call evidence to come to that conclusion. Can any of those conclusions be changed into saying this is how God created the world if you're starting with a premise that there is a God? And the argument that that's not a scientific answer means that you can't separate belief from observation of nature. And this, I think, is the healthiest lesson from Yeshayahu HaNavi, whose chapter 40 was the Haftorah of Shabbat Voet Chanan, Shabbat Nachamu, where he says, Se'u marom einechem, ur'u mi vara ela. Raise, lift your eyes heavenwards, and see who created that stuff. You could get as scientific as you want, but you still can't deny that if you have a starting premise of there is a God, he created the world, he gave the Jewish people the Torah. He gave us a value system by which we are to live. It's all part of the same belief, which when it becomes totally, totally firm in one's heart and mind and soul, you can use the word knowledge. I know that God exists. I know without a doubt that God exists. And when I said that once, I was corrected by the person listening to, no. You believe that God exists. And I said, no. I know that God exists. The same observations you are making in a laboratory for which you come to conclusions that this is how life was formed and this is when that kind of life existed, in my premises that I build upon, I take the same observations and just out of the simple difference between believing in God and not, it changes the conclusions that are drawn. I think I've said enough about this for now. It's a discussion that I'm excited to get into, you know, in any kind of setting. And I have spoken to groups about it, and I have more to say about it. But let's suffice that for Shabbat Bereishit. And just to jump to another Torah science kind of clash that came up over the years of my education, when we studied the internal structure of a shark and of a fetal pig, and were shown how similar they are to the structure of a human embryo or fetus or infant, and the attempt of the science representatives behind that those observations was to show us that we all have a common ancestor and we evolved, then our Hashkafa says, you know why there are similarities from species to species? Because the same divine being created them all, and these similarities are his fingerprints. There's no rule that says that when God created X number of different kinds of animals, that they had to be totally different from each other. In fact, there is a very important value to mammals representing, resembling each other, because it helps us identify. If we were the only species on Earth with a third eye or only one eye, and everybody else, everything else in the animal kingdom had two eyes, we would have a difficult time relating to it. Now, the one question that we didn't get into at all, and we can't, is why God chose the fast forward to bring the world to a certain stage in order to place human beings in it and let them, us, continue from there. But I believe that it's a valid question, and I believe that we can answer it, but not completely. And for that, to me, the most humbling verse in the whole Torah is Hanistarot Lashem Elokeinu. The hidden mysteries are God's. V'haniglot lanu ulevaneinu ad olam. That which he reveals to us, or to put it differently, allows us to reveal and to get insights. But the bottom line, if the whole thing is the end of the pasuk, la'asot et kol divrei ha-Torah hazot, to be faithful to the Torah and God's command. So I was a little agitated during my reading of Origin. And then when I think about it, you can present a very strong case from he who attempted to show that you don't need God in the picture, that God is very much in the picture. Because first he didn't talk about how the things that were the ingredients of life, so to speak, how they came about. And it reminded me, which I did write in Torah Tidbits, about the old joke about the scientist who says to God, "We have finally figured out how to create life, and you are no longer necessary." So God challenges him to a contest. Let's see how it works out. We'll both create life. And the guy, and God says to him, "You go first." And he reaches down and takes a handful of dirt from the ground and says, "We start with this." And then, and before he had a chance to continue, God said, "Get your own dirt. Don't take mine. You get your own dirt." And that's the end. And it's not a joke. I believe it is a very real thing. Because no one will ever be able to explain how the very first something came about. If you can trace things back through scientific observation, extrapolation, etc., to a single hydrogen atom, you're still never going to be able to explain where that first single hydrogen atom came from. And to me, if you're going to go back to there to be puzzled, you might as well go back to Bereshit Bara Elokim Eta Shemayim Beta Aretz and Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, and Vayomer Elokim Na'aseh Adam B'Tzalmeinu Kidmutenu, and realize that that is the starting point as far as human beings are concerned. And the Torah is primarily a code for a proper life for us. And whatever pondering or questions come up about what happened before Bereshit or the realm of heaven or below are symbolically the shape of the bet, which is closed on the top, closed on the back, closed on the bottom, and only open from now forward. It's good to wonder, it's good to speculate, but I wouldn't waste too much energy on it because we just don't have the answers. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, L'Hishtameach.